Nolan.
Thank you. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Nolan. A little disclaimer. I still get nervous when I do this. I get emotional. But don't worry, I have a therapist and a sponsor. So I think the reason I get asked a lot of times to speak is because of my backstory, which is pretty dramatic, pretty extreme. And I think, like, from the outside looking in, just hearing a little bit about it, you know, it tells a story. But then when I fill in the details and the events leading up to it, it's not so glamorous or fantastical, I guess. You know, it's a lot uglier than when you just hear it in passing. So, you know, I'm gonna tell you all the ugly tidbits. And more importantly, I'm gonna tell you how I'm staying sober today and what this program means to me. So I'm in recovery. My sobriety date is January 5th, 2016. Thanks. And the reason I get asked to speak sometimes is for these reasons, because in 2013, I had robbed three banks in about a 6-week period. After robbing the third bank, I got in a high-speed chase. I hit a telephone pole going about 60 miles an hour without a seatbelt on. I got out of the vehicle and got shot 7 times by officers, 5 of which were in my upper torso area. And then I went to prison, and I got sober in prison. And all of that is true. But it's not even close to the whole story, you know. But we'll get to that. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, how I got to that point and then what I've done since then. So I was raised in Visalia, California by 2 loving parents. You know, they're human, so they're faulted, but so am I and so is everyone else. But they were good parents, you know, they were loving. My dad is an alcoholic, actively drinking now, always has been. But he doesn't consider himself an alcoholic because he doesn't go to meetings. That's what he says. Yeah. So growing up, I was a good kid, you know, and I think a lot of times our strengths, when directed in the wrong direction, when pointed in the wrong direction, can become our weaknesses. And can really set us back, and that's true for me. As a kid, I dove into things head first. I was always trying my hardest, and playing sports, and captain of the football team, and doing really good in school when I tried. And that same attitude, that same like all or nothing action that took me down a really bad path later in life. So, growing up, I didn't really use drugs, and just another disclaimer, other substances are part of my story, so I will be talking about those a little bit. So alcohol came into my life pretty young. I noticed my parents would always have people over, and they'd get really drunk, and they'd seem to be having a great time. So I associated alcohol with fun, you know, and that started pretty young. I can't remember the exact age, but 7, 8, 9, you know, I started noticing, oh, they're drinking, you know, the silver bullet, or he's drinking out of that funny bottle again. And boy, dad sure is acting nice tonight, you know. So I associated alcohol with fun. So as I grew up in high school, I started sneaking drinks here and there, drank to blackout, like at a very young age. And I kept doing that throughout high school. I held it together, you know, I would do well in school and play sports and got into college and all that, but whenever I would drink to blackout, and I'd always have to apologize to somebody the next morning, or multiple people in some cases. I knew I was different, you know, the way that I was drinking was abnormal. You know, most of my friends could have a couple and then be responsible in some cases and stop. But I just wasn't interested in stopping. I wanted to keep going. And the next morning, I never remembered how I got to bed. And that happened dozens of times while I was in high school. I ended up going to college. I went to San Diego State. It was my first time, you know, out of the nest. And I got into other substances pretty quickly. I joined a fraternity. I was doing pretty much anything that was put in front of me. And drinking constantly. It almost became a daily habit then. The only time I wouldn't drink was if I was too sick from the day before, you know. So in college, when I started getting into other substances, that's when some consequences started coming my way. And I ended up lasting about a year at San Diego State, and I needed to move. I had some wreckage that I wanted to get away from. So I moved. That will fix it, right? Just change my location. So I moved to Fresno and went to Fresno State. The problem was I came with me, you know, so I kept doing what I was doing. And I was at Fresno State for a couple years. While I was there, I got into other substances even heavier, cocaine specifically. And every time I would drink, my inhibitions would get lowered, and I would do exactly what I promised myself I didn't want to do anymore. And I'd call the guy down the street and stay up all night. And, you know, a lot of relationships got fractured or demolished. I had a longtime girlfriend that I'd been with since high school, and she noticed like the path I was on. She saw me at my worst many times. So that relationship ended when I was about 20, 21. And then I think the night or the day it ended was I went to a Fresno State football game, and I was drinking heavily, and I ended up getting escorted out of the stadium by a police officer. But they didn't just walk me out. I was being such a jackass, excuse my language, they decided to take me down on the field and walk me out of the stadium in front of all the fans. So I walked out, you know, like this. My dad was in the crowd. My soon-to-be ex-girlfriend was looking at me. It's pretty embarrassing. It didn't stop. It didn't stop me. You know, I drank the next day. Not long after that, I ended up getting a DUI. So that was my first, like, legal consequence. I was at this nightclub in Fresno called Millennium. I don't think it's around anymore, but I was there and I drank a bunch of Long Island iced teas, decided I'd drive home, and I ended up like 10 miles in the wrong direction, getting pulled over by a police officer. That was 2001. So back then, they didn't take me to jail even. They gave me a DUI, took me to the hospital and took blood, and then they dropped me off at a gas station and let a friend come pick me up. So I'd never been to jail. At that point, I had handcuffs on my wrist twice, once at the football game and then that night. Again, instead of like addressing the issue, which obviously there was one, instead of addressing the issue, I decided to change locations again. So then I moved to Chico State. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Chico, but the partying didn't stop there, you know. It got worse. So I continued to drink. I met a young woman there. You know, I met a young lady that was also partying quite a bit, and later she would become my wife. And I was able to maintain just enough. You know, I was still going to school most of the time. I would get a job and hold it down for 3-4 months before I'd feel the pressure coming. They were going to fire me, so I'd quit, you know, and I'd switch jobs. I'd always have, like, it looked like I was doing okay, but if you were with me on a day-to-day, you knew that wasn't the case, and I knew it wasn't the case. But I, you know, I would try really hard at whatever job I took for that first couple months. And then it would blow up in my face because my addiction and alcoholism would catch up to me and it'd become apparent, and then I'd run from it. So I thought that that would fix it. You know, I'd just keep changing what I was doing, hiding the facts from myself and from my family and from my employers, and it didn't work out so well. I ended up trying opiates for the first time, which it was a prescription painkiller. It was called OxyContin. So I tried that when I was in college, and like everything else in my life, you know, I started doing it as often as possible, and as I did my best at it. I dove into it. And unlike the other substances that I was taking, that one got me physically addicted, you know, so I was unable to stop. I would tell myself, this is the last time I'm doing it, tomorrow I'm quitting, and tomorrow never came. And it really gets its hooks in you bad, and the withdrawal symptoms are pretty unbearable. And I took that addiction with me when I left Chico. I left college and went back to Visalia with the young lady that I had met. She wasn't aware that I was using opiates, but you know, I would go to extremes to keep that addiction going. I would drive down to Mexico quite often. If I couldn't find the prescription pills that I needed to stay well, I would drive down to Tijuana, walk across the border, buy as many as I can afford, and drive back. And I did that probably a dozen times. More than one of those occasions, I got arrested by the Mexican police and had to pay them bribes. And my life was becoming unmanageable, I think. I was addicted to opiates for probably about 2 or 3 years. It was, at this point, it was 2003, and I just got fired from a job that my father had gotten me. I was in the produce business. I was inspecting grapes and tree fruit and things like that. One day I was at work and I was nodding off at my desk. You know, I was on the computer and I'm nodding off, and my boss noticed. And then they drug tested me, and I obviously couldn't pass it. So I ended up losing that job, and now my family knew. So they got involved. My mom was the quarterback. You know, I wanted people to leave me alone, but my mom wouldn't let that happen. She wanted me to go to treatment. So I went to a treatment facility in 2003. It was called The Camp. It still is there. It's in Scotts Valley out by Santa Cruz. So I went to the Camp Recovery Center, and I got clean. I was there for 28 days. I detoxed with medication, and then I finally was off those opiates, and I stayed in treatment until the end of that 30-day or 28-day cycle when my insurance wouldn't pay for my treatment anymore, and then I was cured, right? I'm cured now, so go home. So I went home, and, you know, my dad is... He doesn't like talking about addiction or about alcoholism or about recovery, still to this day. And so he was ashamed of me. I could tell, you know, we just pretended that that had never happened, right? So we just, that's in the past, let's move forward. And we went fishing like a weekend after I got out, and he offered me alcohol. Which I was like, hell yeah, I can drink again, right? So I started drinking pretty quickly after I got out of treatment. I was embarrassed that now I'm labeled an addict. You know, my friends knew that I'd been to treatment, my parents, my brothers. So I decided to join the Marine Corps, because then I could be Nolan the Marine instead of Nolan the drug addict. So I did. I joined the Marine Corps. About a month after I got out of rehab, I was in boot camp. Dove into that. I did really well in the Marines. And, you know, especially when I didn't get any leave. I did really well when I wasn't allowed to do whatever I wanted to do. Once I started getting leave, I was blackout drinking really quickly. I stayed away from drugs while I was in the Marine Corps just because there was consequences and repercussions. They drug test quite a bit, So especially when you first join. So I stayed away from the drugs and used alcohol. It's legal, you know, everyone does it, so why not? I drank quite a bit, got myself in a hell of a lot of trouble when I was on leave. Did a few things that could have got me arrested. For instance, one night I'm out at a club, it's on base, and I'm in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri at that point, and I was blacked out drunk, and this big sergeant, that he wasn't from my unit, I'd never seen him before, but we'd gotten an argument, and I instead of getting my ass kicked, I decided that I'm a captain. Don't mess with me, I'm an officer, right? Which impersonating an officer isn't a very good idea. It's one of the many things that I did while I was drinking in the Marine Corps. After almost 5 years, I discharged, never got sent overseas. My unit went into 29 Palms at one point. But, you know, I never was in country. I was here in the U.S. the whole time. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I continued drinking. I ended up really drunk on a golf course one day. A friend of mine that was an MMA fighter, he still is, actually. He's like 48, and he still does it. But he was injured, and we're golfing together, and I saw that he was taking a Norco, which is another type of opiate. It's like a Vicodin. So I saw him taking a Norco, and hey, can I have one of those? My back hurts. And back to the races, right? So I'm off to the races with opiates again. Within a week, I'm physically addicted. I'm going to doctor's offices. I still had a valid military ID, so I'd go in there and say, I just got out of the Marine Corps. My back's killing me. I got injured. You know, just manipulating. And doctors would give me those pills really easily in 2009. So I was back addicted to opiates and constantly drinking. I didn't really drink and use pills at the same time because I would get sick. You can't drink too much when you're on opiates. But if I wasn't taking opiates, which I almost always was, I was drinking. I ended up getting married in 2009. To that same young lady. Now that I'd been to rehab, I was so embarrassed that I started using again. You know, my family thought alcohol was okay because I was cured. I didn't have to worry about drinking alcohol. I'm allowed to do that. But I could not admit that I was using drugs again. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. I didn't want to have to go back to rehab. I didn't want people to know that I had a problem, so I hid it. So in 2009, we got married. I was using the day I got married. I was using the day after I got married. I was just telling a person here that I went to the Bahamas and went to an AA meeting when I was there. That was on a honeymoon. I was using when I was in the Bahamas, going to meetings, pretending that I was sober. You know, I'm really ashamed of that. I used to go to meetings, and I would be taking fistfuls of pills before I'd go to these meetings because I wanted to appear as if I wasn't using. I wanted my family to think I was okay. I wanted my wife to think I was still doing the right thing, but I wasn't. I was lying to myself, lying to everybody around me. And those lies are what ended up getting me where I was that day that I got shot. Lies build upon each other. You know, they start small and they just stack and stack and stack. And I felt like I couldn't admit to any of them because then the whole tower would come tumbling down. So I had all these lies stacked up. And my marriage was a sham. The job I had at that point, obviously I wouldn't have it if they knew what I was doing. It's crazy how quick things get out of control. So in 2009, I got married. I got a job again in the produce business. I was exporting now. So I would travel all over the world. I flew to Vietnam, Singapore, Malaysia, I mean, Thailand, all over the place. And 1 year, and it was 2010, I got like 150,000 miles on an airline, which I was really proud of. I was smuggling drugs everywhere I went. I remember one time I flying into Singapore, you have to sign like this waiver that says, I am not smuggling any narcotics. And if you are, it warns you, you're going to get life in prison, life. And I signed it, and I had a big Tylenol bottle full of Norco because I couldn't stop. I mean, what am I supposed to do, right? I flew all over Asia, but then I also would live down in South America quite a bit. So I was in mainly table grapes. So when it was winter here in California, I would go to Chile and Peru and Argentina, and I'd live down there for 3-4 months at a time. And so obviously I couldn't take enough pills to last me that long. So I'd have to fly back, you know, some type of emergency. So I'd fly back, buy a bunch more pills, and then go back to Chile. I did whatever I needed to do to keep my pocket full of those things. And then when I'd run out, I would drink to excess. And alcohol stayed part of my life the entire time. I was always either drinking or taking pills. In 2012, by that point, I'm taking about 40 Norcos a day. So I'm waking up in the morning, holding down a job. I'm making really good money. I was making six figures, but I was broke, dead broke. I was spending $1,000 a week on pills. Back then, they were like $3, $4, $5 each. And I needed 40 a day. So do the math. It's a lot of money and a lot of opiates going in my system. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd take 10 of those damn things. And by, you know, that would maybe 6 a.m. I'd wake up, take 10 pills, have a cup of coffee, go to work like a normal person. And then I'd by 10, 11 o'clock, I'd have to take 10 more. By 2 or 3, I'd have to take 10 more. And then come 5, 6 at night, I'd take 10 more and try to hold out until 6 a.m. That was my life for well over a year. Because of my drug use, I was getting into debt. So I'm refinancing cars that I don't own. My name was on the purchase of my company car, and I refinanced it. They found out pretty quick. That wasn't good. Those check into cash saved my ass many times in the short term. And then it was even in a bigger rut 2 weeks later when I had to pay it back. I borrowed money from my father-in-law. I borrowed money from my best friend. I borrowed money from my brothers. I borrowed money from everybody. Anyone that loved me, I used it against them. And I would get them to give me what I needed. So when I'm in debt to all these people that I love, right? I'm in debt to all those closest to me. So I was in a spot where I just didn't know what to do. I needed my pills. I owed everyone and their brother money. And I'm working full time. It just didn't make sense from the outside looking in. And I mean, looking back, it's like, what are you, stupid? You just ask for help, man. Ask for help. Admit it. But I didn't. I had too much ego, too much stupidity. I didn't ask for help. So I just continued the lie, continued manipulating those people that were closest to me. Those were the easiest ones to manipulate. So in all this financial trouble, I didn't know what to do, and I started getting desperate. I was thinking, like, what's my best route? Like, what can I do to solve this problem? I plan on quitting next week. I'm going to quit taking these damn pills. How do I fix it to get to next week? So I decided that robbing a bank was the best way out of it. And I think that stupid idea came to mind. I had a friend that had worked at a bank in high school. She was a teller. And I remember her telling me one time that if someone comes in and passes a note, they're supposed to just give you the money and let you go to get you out of the bank. I remember her telling me that. And so, ding, oh, I don't have to hurt anybody. I just get 10, 15 grand and get out of there, pay off most of my debt, and then I'll wean myself off of those pills. I can do it. And it didn't work. So the first one I robbed was on May 20th, 2013. The day I did it, let's back up. On May 13th, a week before that, I planned on robbing this bank in Visalia. It's called Tacomas. It's on Wintondale near Mooney. And I parked my car a couple blocks away. I concealed my identity. I wore a beanie. It's like May. It's not cold. But I wore a beanie. I had a change of clothes on underneath the clothes I was wearing. I put makeup all over my face. I had a handkerchief that I would hold over my face, pretending I'm blowing my nose when I walked in, and I planned on just holding it there. I put on a fanny pack, so whatever money they gave me, I would throw in the fanny pack and take off running. I planned on jumping a bunch of fences and then getting into my car, or actually jumping onto a bicycle first, riding a bike down an alley, ditching the bike, jumping another fence, getting into my car and going home. Actually, no, going to the dealer's house. So that was the plan. I walked up to Tacoma's credit union and I opened the doors and I threw up all over the place. My nerves got the best of me and I just threw up. And I freaked out and I left. So a week later, I built up the desperation. I built up it definitely wasn't courage. It was stupidity. It was desperation. It was, I guess that's the best word, desperation. And I did it. I went to a Wells Fargo in Tulare. I'd been there before. I banked at Wells Fargo, so I'd been to that bank. There was an alley that a one-way street near it. So I had this plan that I would run the wrong way down the one-way street, jump on a bike. Same stupid plan, right? And it worked. I got away. I got about $8,000, I think, if I remember correctly. Drove right from the bank, and I got this adrenaline rush after I did it. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe I got away with it. I was crying in my car. I just couldn't believe it. I don't think shame played a part yet into the crying, you know. It was just like, maybe I'm going to get away with this. Maybe I can get to the other side of this. I drove straight to the dealer's house, paid him the $1,000 I owed him, got a pocket full of pills, and I started paying off my family and my friends with money that I stole from robbing a bank. And then 2 weeks went by. I didn't wean myself off those pills. 2 weeks went by, and I'm still in a bad spot financially. I mean, hell, it worked once. Why not do it again? So I did it again. I robbed the Visalia Community Bank on Caldwell in Visalia. I went in there, same plan. This time, instead of getting the money from one teller, I got the money from three tellers. And then I jumped a fence, got away. So I got a little bit more money that time. Went home, counted it, allotted it. Okay, this is going to my father-in-law. This is going to my dealer. This is going. And then within 3-4 days, that money was gone. And I'm still hooked on opiates. So a couple weeks go by, and I did it again. This time I wasn't planning on it. It was, I needed to go to Mexico for a week for work. So I planned on, all of a sudden, I had to fly out the next morning. So now I need a week's worth of medication, and I owe the dealer like $800. So I can't just go without the pills. I'm flying into this place I've never been. So I decided to go back to the same place I robbed the first time. So I went back to the same Wells Fargo in Tulare. It was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It was really busy. There was 15 customers in there, which any one of them could have been a cop. Any one of them could have had a gun. They could have shot me in the back of the head while I'm doing what I'm doing. I didn't care. That didn't stop me. So this time, I didn't get away with it. This time, there was a CDC sergeant that was, he worked at Corcoran Prison. And I know all this looking back from the police report. There's a CDC sergeant that's seeing what's going on through the window of the drive-through teller. And he sees what I'm doing. So after I got the money and ran out, he followed me. So he drove the wrong way down the one-way street, saw me running. He saw me jump the fence, drove around a neighborhood, saw me get in my car, finally. I was wearing all different clothes by that point, but he noted, I mean, I'm running and getting into a car as fast as I can. He knew it was the same guy. So he stayed back and he like tailed me. And I knew someone was following me because first of all, they were staying back. It was odd. And then I made four right turns. The guy made four right turns. That makes no sense. So I knew I was being tailed. So then I started driving like a bat out of hell through Tulare, California to get away. I thought I got away from him, but in retrospect and after reading the police report, the cops on the other line, he was on the phone with 911. They're telling him, stop chasing him. You guys are going to kill someone. You know, I was driving 90 through neighborhoods to get away from this guy. I could have hit someone. I have kids, you know. If I would have killed someone, Jesus. Really glad that no one got hurt but me. So I drove through town, got away. I ended up back in Visalia. I thought I'd gotten away with it. So I'm at an intersection about a block from my house. That day, I had family was coming over to my house for a barbecue. So I just robbed a bank. I'm driving home to cook for my nephews and nieces and my brother and my parents. They're waiting for me. I'm about an hour late. I pull up to this intersection and an unmarked vehicle pulls up behind me, but it had lights underneath, like behind the glass inside the car. So I knew it was a cop. And I saw him talking on his radio. So I thought, maybe it's a coincidence. Maybe I'm going to get away with this. And then a Tahoe, a white Tahoe with lights on top, pulled up behind him. And then they turned on their lights. And I knew I was screwed. So, and this is all part of the story people don't hear about, you know. So I looked in my rearview mirror. I had a choice to make at that point. It's either just pull over and take my medicine, which I 100% deserved. I knew that I thought at that point I was going to prison for 20 years. I'd never been in trouble before besides that, you know, a DUI. So I was scared. I didn't want to face my family. I didn't want to face my now ex-wife. So I decided that the best solution to that problem at that point was to just check out, to kill myself. So I took my seatbelt off and I hit the gas. I found the nearest telephone pole. It was about a half mile away and I accelerated through it. I was going about 60. The telephone pole snapped. I didn't die. So the telephone pole swung on the wires and I went right through it. My head hit the windshield. I ended up in the passenger seat. I was knocked out. I had blood coming down my head. And I came to and I'm in this cloud of dust and I hear people yelling. It was the police officers that surrounded the vehicle. And I realized I was still alive. Oh shit. So I didn't know what to do. And then I thought, okay, see it through. So I opened the passenger door and got out, and there was a cop from me to this gentleman in the front, about that far away, maybe 15, 20 feet, and he had his gun trained on me. And there was another officer that I didn't know was there behind me to my right, about the same distance away. And so I went to my waist and pulled my hand up like that, getting him to fire. I didn't have a weapon, but if I was a cop, I'd shoot back too. So that officer fired his weapon. This officer fired their weapon. They fired 18 rounds. 7 of them hit me. I got shot once in the chest right here by my heart, once in the shoulder, once in the left arm, once in the neck, once in my rib cage back here, and then once in my butt and once in my knee. Both of my lungs were punctured. I spun around and went down. I started gasping, you know, pretty quickly. I remember I was laying on my face, and a cop walked up and looked at me. One of the cops that had fired on me, I'm assuming. He walked up and said, "Well, he's dead." And he turned around and walked away and left me there. So I thought I was dead. You know, I thought, okay, that's it. And now it's coming. So one of the cops came up and sat me on my butt, put handcuffs on me, and I looked down, and I had a white shirt on, and it's just soaked. I saw like air bubbles coming out of one of my wounds, which I know from the Marine Corps is a sucking chest wound. And that's not good. It's usually that's it. So I was gasping for air, and I looked up. Living the lifestyle I was living and doing the things I was doing, a connection with a higher power didn't play a large part in my life at that point. But I looked up, and I think about that all the time now. Like I looked up and I waited for a bright light or something to come and get me. And I'm sitting there gasping, and I'm looking up, and I'm waiting, and I'm looking up and I'm waiting, and I hear sirens coming. And the bright light didn't come. The ambulance came, and they put me on a gurney. Or I guess it's called a stretcher. They put me on a stretcher, and they started pumping air into my lungs. I was conscious this whole time. They took me to the emergency room in Visalia at Cahuilla Delta Hospital. I remember I was in a lot of pain at that point. It was probably 20, 30 minutes after I had been shot, and I started begging for morphine. Like, give me morphine, please, give me morphine. And they said, no, you've lost too much blood. We can't. I ended up getting chest tubes put in both of my lungs. I was awake for that. They started digging into one of my wounds, I'm assuming to get a bullet out. I don't know. But that's when I passed out from pain. The next 5 years of my life were in prison, incarcerated. I didn't stop at that point. You know, I was in the hospital for about a month. I went to the infirmary when I got put in jail. And the first phone call I made was to my ex-wife, asked her, are you leaving? She said, yes. So, which I have, come on, who can blame her? What I really feel bad about is that day that I went to the hospital. I hear about that day sometimes from my mom. Sorry. She tells me how she found out what was going on. Someone called her and said that I was in a car accident. So she went to the scene. And the cops told her that I'd been shot. And they wouldn't tell her if I was alive or dead. So she's at the hospital. She's at the hospital just trying to find out if her son's alive. I hate that. I didn't get to talk to her for about a month. Yeah. Thank God for my therapist. So I ended up in jail, and I didn't really engage in my recovery for a couple years. My bottom, it was a long stretch. You know, I'm in jail. I had lost everything that I thought was important. I found out later, you know, obviously it wasn't. The marriage dissolved. My job was gone. The home I owned is gone. The respect of my friends and family at that point was totally gone. I lost pretty much everyone in my life. And I was in prison, and I was still using drugs. I justified it by saying, you know, why not? I lost everything anyway, who cares? I was drinking, I was using, and I ended up in solitary confinement. It was January 5th, 2016. And I looked in the mirror, and I hated myself. I hated the reflection I saw. I hated what I'd become. I didn't know what to do, but I knew I didn't want to be that person. You know, I'm from Visalia. I'm from a good family. I had support. You know, my mom was still there for me. She'd come to see me every other weekend for 5 years while I was in there. So at January 5th, 2016, I'd been sober a couple days. I hadn't used or drank, but it's just because I was in solitary confinement. Like, it wasn't for lack of trying. So at that point, I decided I didn't really know what recovery looked like. I know what I had learned at rehab, but I decided to start doing the right thing, trying to do the right thing, one choice at a time. I ended up hooking up with a sponsor shortly thereafter. His name is Mike. He's still my sponsor. I had a couple. He was in prison for getting in a car accident, and his girlfriend got ejected from the car and died. He was under the influence. So he did 14 years in there. He just got out 2 years ago. And when he got out, he became my sponsor again. Anyway, he's a great sponsor. He made me go through the steps like 110%. The first step took me months. You know, it's a sight to be in prison, sitting at a table, working the steps. You don't see that very often in there. Mike walked me through the steps. I got on the list to go to the H&I meetings that come inside the walls every week, and I showed up every single week. I became of service. I was at first the coffee man, and then I became a secretary. And I went to those meetings religiously, NA and AA, every single time that I was able to. Working the steps it changed my life. You know, it's not just a program of sobriety and recovery. It changes the way that we interact with people. It changes the way that I live my life. My friendships now they're based in honesty. Respect. I know that if my car would have broke down driving up here today, I would have called someone in the program, guarantee it, and they would have showed up. I could not have said that 10 years ago. You know, that's special. All of my friends today, 95% of my friends today are in the program. I mean, it changed my whole life. It changed the way that I'm married now. I have kids. I got out of prison in 2018, in July. Not that long ago. It's been 4 years and 1 month. When I was incarcerated, I went back to school. I took as many classes as I could before I got out. And when I got out, through Project Rebound, I went back to Cal State Bakersfield and took psychology courses. I took drug and alcohol counseling classes. I took every damn class I could take. When I got out, I got into drug and alcohol treatment. I started working for a facility out of Newport Beach. And shortly thereafter, I met my now wife. I owe everything to this program. I owe everything to my sobriety. I owe everything to my higher power. I should be dead, you know? And I think the reason I lived that day was to do what I'm doing today, to be a father, to be a good father, and to give back, to work the 12th step, to do exactly what I'm doing today. I know that's why I lived. I'm the executive director at a treatment facility in Fresno now. I couldn't get a job 4 years ago. I tried to get hired at Target. Nope. Tried to get hired at Kohl's, restocking shit on the shelves. Excuse my language. Nope. They wouldn't hire me. I'm a felon. Tried to get hired as a forklift driver at a packing house. Nope. So I kept going. I walked to school. I rode a bus for 6 months. When I got an opportunity to work in this industry and to help people for a living, I jumped at it and I dove in 100%. I work my ass off and I love it. I love what I do today. I love it. I worked my way up pretty quickly. You know, I went from alumni coordinator to business development rep pretty quickly thereafter to an executive director at a facility. And that's nuts. That's my higher power. Today, I have a lot, you know, a lot that I never thought I'd have. I have a wife that I love. I have a 2-year-old son, biological son, that I love being a dad. I love it. And I'm proud. I'm proud of myself. You know, I like being proud of myself. It's pretty damn cool. I work with a sponsor. I have sponsees. It's my life's great. And I mean, now when shit happens all the time, you know, I can't pay a bill or somebody gets in a car accident, and you know, there's all kinds of shit that happens in life, but I'm able to address those things as they come. Address them. That's it. I take the next appropriate step. And I owe that to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe that to my sponsor. Thank God that I have such a good sponsor that answers when I call, that works the steps with me still. I mean, 6 years later, we still go through the steps every month. We're on the next step, you know. And every time I go through them, that 4-step gets longer and longer. And the amends I make, they get harder and harder. The coolest amends I've ever made since I got sober was I was able to track down those officers that shot me. And this was almost 3 years ago. And I went to the precinct where they work now. One of them had switched precincts. And when I got there, they didn't know what to think. You know, I got frisked numerous times. They thought I was there for retribution. So I was able to shake their hands and apologize and say, I'm really sorry that I put you through that. I should have never put you in that situation. That was really selfish of me. I was a coward. I'm proud of that, you know, and I now work out with one of those cops. I think I went over my time, but you know, if you take anything from this, just I guess take what you need and leave the rest. But I'm grateful to be here. Welcome to all the newcomers. Thank you.